It's 7:01. Welcome to Clarifying the Sage's Intent Discussion Group. And we'll start by saying the refuge prayer in English only. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Ratna Mandala Pudza Mega Samunda Saparana Samaya Om. So welcome to our first live broadcast of Clarifying the Sage's Intent Discussion Group. We're going to be using two books this evening. One is the commentary on the Clarifying the Sage's Intent by Ape Rinpoche, which is a smaller volume. And the other is the actual text itself. See if I can get that visible. Sakyapandita's actual text of Clarifying the Sage's Intent. And we'll be doing some reading from the text of the commentary by Ape Rinpoche. I'll be making some extra comments from Sakyapandita's original text. And then there'll be time for a little bit of discussion and questions from the folks who are here. We're not set up to take questions online yet. Maybe someday we'll have that. But hopefully you can hear us and see us okay. So we've been running this group for several weeks now, and we have covered a few of the beginning chapters. But I think it might be a good idea to just say a few words about Clarifying the Sage's Intent, how it was written and where it came from. So Clarifying the Sage's Intent was written by Sakyapandita, who was a great Tibetan scholar and master. And he lived in the 12th century, 12th and 13th century. And he wrote this book towards the end of his life as a practice manual. So it's a book that covers basically from the beginning to the end, from before becoming a Buddhist, through becoming a Buddhist, the practice of being a Bodhisattva Buddhist, and the final fruit, which is enlightenment. So it's a bit of a roadmap for spiritual development, for the Bodhisattva's path. And Sakyapandita taught this text more than any other text that he taught. He taught it all over a number of different countries in the latter part of his life. Now, the book is based on two lines from another book, which is Maitreya's Ornament of the Mahayana Sutras. So it might be interesting to know who Maitreya was and how did Sakya Pandita get a hold of Maitreya's book. So the entire Clarifying the Sage's Intent text is based on only two lines in the other book. So I think it might be interesting to just go back in time a little bit and recount the story of how all of this happened. So Maitreya is known as the coming Buddha, or the Buddha to come. And so that raises the question, well, how do we know that? And where is he? And how did we get his books? So as we said in the previous classes, the path itself of the Bodhisattva Bhumi path, there are 10 levels. And the 10th level is the final step before enlightenment. So when the historical Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha, was at that level, the 10th level, he had another student. He had a student was also at that level, and that student was Maitreya. That's really distracting me, all this stuff. Can you just keep a hold of her a little bit? There's a dog running around here getting kisses and hugs from everybody. So the Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, who lived in India 2,600 years ago, and Maitreya were both on the 10th Bhumi, and as Shakyamuni Buddha was about to become enlightened, he passed his crown on to his student Maitreya, and he told Maitreya that Shakyamuni Buddha, he said that he was going to take rebirth in the human realm in order to help sentient beings. Now, all of the Buddhas in the current time period, and there are a thousand of them, all of them have been prophesied. So it was known that Shakyamuni Buddha is the fourth of these thousand, and Maitreya will be the fifth. So that was already known by prophecy. So Shakyamuni Buddha descended, took rebirth in India, taught for 45 years or so, and then passed into Parinirvana. He left his teachings and the scriptures that were written down about the teachings. And those were studied by masters in the following centuries. In the fourth century in India, there was a master who was born who was named Asanga. And Asanga was a great philosophy teacher at Nalanda Institute, or Nalanda University, which was one of the great philosophical universities in India. And so as a result of his studies, he knew about the thousand Buddhas, and he knew that Maitreya was going to be, or is going to be, the next coming Buddha. So as many of these scholars were, Asanga was also a great practitioner. And so he wanted to meet Maitreya Buddha. I'm not sure how he got this idea, but he decided that he wanted to. And so he decided that the way to do that would be to go into strict retreat for 3 years and supplicate Maitreya and ask him to appear and teach him. So he went into a solitary retreat for 3 years, a strict retreat, and as some of you probably know, these retreats are quite strict. The person is closed into a cave or a retreat room with no contact with anybody. They're not seen by anybody. They don't see anybody. The food might be passed through a hole in the wall. They might be sealed in. But it's a very intensive practice. So Asanga spent 3 years in strict retreat supplicating Maitreya. And after the 3 years, no Maitreya appeared. So Asanga left the retreat. He went out and he saw somebody cutting a rock with a thread, going back and forth with a thread, and slowly, slowly, slowly cutting the rock. And he said to himself, well, if a little thread can cut a rock with enough time, then I should be able to not be so impatient, and I should give enough time for having contact with Maitreya. So Asanga went back into retreat and did another 3-year retreat, strict retreat, closed in. And so after the end of the second 3-year period, in other words, after 6 years, still no Maitreya. So he exited the retreat. He went outside. He saw water dripping on a rock, slowly drip, drip, dripping. And he said to himself, well, if water can wear away a rock, I shouldn't be so impatient, and I should continue my practice. And so he went back into retreat again, and he did another 3-year retreat. And so now we're talking about 9 years in retreat. I don't know if any of you have ever done a 9-year retreat, but I can imagine that it's a very intense experience. So he did another 3 years, and after that 3-year period, there was still no sign of Maitreya. So he went out from the retreat, and he saw an eagle who had nested on a rock on the side of a mountain, and he was going into this sort of rock structure and brushing the side of the rock with his eagle feathers. And the rock was being worn down by the slow caress of the eagle feathers. And he said to himself, well, why can't I be as patient as the eagle? And I should have more patience and a better practice. So he went back into retreat again for another 3 years. And after that 3-year retreat, so after a total of 12 years of retreat, he started to wonder if Maitreya was going to show up or not, or what was going on. So at the end of the 3-year retreat, he left the retreat again. And as he went out from his retreat hut, he saw a sickly dog, a mangy dog who had a lot of sores on his body. And there were maggots in the sores eating the dog. So Asanga saw this and was moved with great compassion, because while he had not seen Maitreya in the 12 years of retreat, he had developed an intense compassion for sentient beings. So when he saw the poor dog with the disease and the maggots, he felt compassion not only for the dog, but also for the maggots. And so he was trying to think, well, what can I do here to help this situation? So he decided that he would try to entice the maggots with some fresh meat. And so he cut a slice of his own thigh and offered his own flesh to the maggots. Unfortunately, the maggots were not impressed and they didn't budge. And so it didn't work. And so then he was trying to figure out, well, now what can I do? Because he thought, well, if I grab the maggots and pull them off the dog and stick them on the meat, I might kill them in the process. And he didn't want to do that because he had compassion also for the maggots. So he thought about it and he finally decided that he would get down on his hands and knees and he would remove the maggots from the dog with his own tongue, because his tongue was soft. That's how much compassion that he had for the maggots and the dog. And as soon as he did that, the dog instantly appeared and changed into Maitreya. And so I don't know what Asanga thought, but I can imagine he was quite surprised. And he said to Maitreya, I just spent 12 years in retreat. Where were you? And Maitreya said, I was there the whole time, but you didn't see me because you had too many obscurations in front of your vision. And Asanga believed him, but he was still a little bit doubtful. He wasn't quite sure. And Maitreya said, well, I'll prove it to you. Put me on your shoulders and take me into town. So Asanga agreed. He hoisted Maitreya on his shoulders, walked into the town, and started talking to people and asking them, do you see anything on my shoulders? Nobody saw anything. nobody could see the Maitreya because, of course, they had obscurations also. And person after person said, no, I don't see anything. Why? Until finally there was one old woman who was very pure practitioner. She didn't see Maitreya, she saw the dog. And so that was enough to convince a Sangha that Maitreya is there. It's just a question of the obscurations that we have that prevent us from seeing him. So at that point, a Sangha requested to Maitreya to receive teachings from him. So Maitreya took a Sangha to what's called Tushita Heaven. Now, usually Buddhas reside in realms that are called Buddha realms. And these realms are very difficult for ordinary beings to access due to karma and various obscurations and so on. But in this case, Tushita Heaven is more accessible. And so a Sangha was able to go to Tushita Heaven where Maitreya resides. And Maitreya granted him the teaching of five of Maitreya's texts. Now, the story is that it only took one morning for Maitreya to transmit these. He transmitted them orally. Asanga, being the great scholar that he was, he had total recall, and so he remembered every word of the five texts. And that all happened in the course of one morning. Asanga returned to India, but there's a time difference between India and Tushita Heaven, or our realm and that realm. So what's only one morning in that realm is actually 50 years in our time. So Asanga was gone 50 years, but he came back with the five texts. Because he had total recall, he remembered them and he could write them down. And one of the texts is the Ornament of Mahayana Sutras, two lines of which are the basis for Sakya Pandita's Clarifying the Sage's Intent. So Clarifying the Sage's, the Ornament of Mahayana Sutras is known and studied in the great philosophical universities. And so when Sakya Pandita came along in the 12th and the 13th century, of course, he was quite familiar with that text. And he didn't have to rely on any translations because he was fluent in Sanskrit himself, even though he was a Tibetan. By the way, Sakya Pandita is not a name, it's a title. So Sakya refers to the geographical part of Tibet where Sakya Pandita was born and lived. And Pandita is an honorary title that comes from India, which is granted when a person has mastered the five major sciences and the five minor sciences. And Sakya Pandita was the first Tibetan to ever be given that title. He was given that title by his Indian teacher, who was also a Pandita or Pandit. Sakya Pandita's name is Kunga Gyaltsen. So Sakya Pandita decided that it would be a good idea, after practicing for a lifetime, to write down the path to enlightenment for regular people, beginners, people on the street, so to speak. And he went all around teaching this text. In fact, this text has some alternative titles, one of which is the text that was taught to everybody. And so this text comes down to us today. The commentary is by Apé Rinpoché, who was a very famous Tibetan Lama of the 20th century. And he has, this was actually a teaching that he gave in Singapore that was recorded and then transcribed and put into book form. So, as I said, the text is basically a roadmap for enlightenment. The first chapter starts with a person who is not even a Buddhist yet, but basically talks about how everybody has a spiritual potential, but some people have developed it and other people haven't. The people who have developed spiritual potential have a tendency towards virtue, a tendency towards being helpful, a tendency towards wanting to do spiritual practice. Those people who then decide to go on the spiritual path of a Buddhist then take a formal step, which is called going for refuge, and that's the second chapter of the book. The different kinds of refuge, how we produce it, and how we go on to the path. The path that we're talking about, there's many paths even within Buddhism, there's many paths, and we're talking about the Bodhisattva path, which is what Sakyapandita concerns himself with. So once a person takes refuge, then what do? If you're a Mahayana or a great vehicle practitioner, you practice what are called the six perfections. So the six perfections take up a large part of this book, although there are some chapters after that. And so Sakyapandita begins by explaining the various six perfections, what they are, how to practice them, what are the results in this life and in the next life, and what is the final fruit. And the first of the six perfections is the perfection of generosity, which is the basis for all the other perfections. And we have covered that in previous discussions, so we won't do that tonight. But the second of the six perfections is the perfection of morality. So it's important to know that these perfections are not just simple generosity or simple morality, which lots of people have, but the perfection of these. And so the discussion revolves around what are these perfections and what makes them the perfection of the perfection. How do you make it perfect, in other words? So the next chapter is the second perfection, which is the perfection of morality. And again, lots of people have morality, but if we're going to be on the Mahayana path or the great vehicle path, we have to understand how do we perfect the practice of morality. So that's where we're going to start tonight. So fortunately, we have somebody who's going to read for us, and you won't have to listen to me all night. So I'm going to ask Sybil to start reading chapter 5, which is the perfection of morality.
The second of the six perfections is the perfection of morality. Generally speaking, morality refers to the mental state which longs to discard non-virtuous deeds. It is the foundation for practicing patience, meditation, and the other perfections. Since all practices require discipline, the practice of moral discipline is necessary training for everything to follow. It is like preparing the soil to grow crops. When we later on engage in other virtuous actions, they will increase and multiply, and the flow of positive results will be incessant. On the other hand, without the support of moral discipline, we will not succeed in developing any of the other spiritual qualities.
So, in a way, this kind of makes sense. It's sort of common sense that if you're going to be a spiritual practitioner on a spiritual path, you have to be a moral person. You can't be a great meditator and then run around and lie and steal and kill people. It doesn't make any sense. So the morality, as it says, is preparing the soil for these other perfections to grow. So the perfections are based one on another, and they're in a specific order for a specific reason. So the morality is underneath all the other perfections, and it supports them.
The way to transform mundane morality into the perfection of morality is to engage in it with the motivation to liberate all sentient beings, conjoined with the Mahayana view of ultimate reality. When both the enlightenment thought and the Mahayana view of ultimate reality are conjoined with morality, it becomes the perfection of morality. Although ordinary worldlings and those on the Hinayana path also engage in morality, it is not possible for them to practice the perfection of morality because they do not generate the enlightenment thought and they lack the Mahayana view of ultimate reality.
Okay, so here Ape Rinpoche, he gets right to the point, describing what needs to happen in order for morality to be perfected. So what he says is, we have to have two things. The enlightenment thought is the first one. Now, what does he mean by the enlightenment thought? That's sort of shorthand for saying, my aspiration and my action is to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In other words, sentient beings are suffering. I'm not really in a position right now where I can do much of anything to help them, but a Buddha can. And so what I will do is I will go and practice the great vehicle path, attain enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings, not for my own sake. If I do it just for my own sake and I relieve my own suffering and I leave everybody else behind, what kind of deal is that? So the first quality that I have to have is the enlightenment thought for the sake of all beings. The second quality is the Mahayana view of the ultimate reality. What does that mean? That means I have to accomplish the realization of emptiness or interdependence. We're not going to go into that topic tonight because it's beyond our scope. But those are the two prerequisites, according to Apri Rinpoche, which turn regular morality into the perfection of morality.
There are three ways in which our morality may be impaired. Number one, through not guarding the morality we have promised to maintain. Number two, through following the wrong type of morality, such as the morality of other religious traditions. And number three, through practicing the morality of the Hinayana path, which cannot become the cause for gaining full and perfect enlightenment.
Okay, so the first of these, not guarding the morality we have promised to maintain, is going to be discussed later on in this chapter. In other words, the promising or taking vows, and so we'll talk about that later. The second one, following the wrong type of morality, such as the morality of other religious traditions. What that refers to, remember we're talking about ancient India now, or Tibet when this was written, and there were some groups that practiced, for example, animal slaughter, thinking that that's an offering to a god or a goddess. And that kind of morality doesn't have any place here because killing is not a moral act. And so those kinds of actions are the wrong type of morality. And then the third one, practicing the morality of the Hinayana path, what that refers to is not having this motivation that we discussed a minute ago, which is, I'm going to do the path for the benefit of all beings. If I just do it for myself, that's a Hinayana path or a lesser motivation. And because we're talking about Mahayana practice here, that's considered a moral fault.
The unfavorable consequence of impairing our morality, accruing in this lifetime, is that we will be criticized by the people around us. We will also feel ashamed, even to appear before our teacher, to sit with other members of the Sangha, or to receive offerings. This is because when we know our morality is not pure, it instills a kind of cowardice or timidity within us. We'll feel very small when we receive offerings. Not only will other people criticize and blame us, but non-humans will also make obstacles for us. Gods who protected us in the past will no longer protect us, and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will be displeased with us. The unfavorable consequence accruing in the next life is rebirth in one of the lower realms. Unless we guard our morality properly, we will not be protected from taking birth there, even if we listen to the teachings and study them well. It is said that if we commit the 10 non-virtuous deeds, we will definitely be reborn in the lower realms. Even if we commit only some of the minor non-virtues, this may also lead to rebirth there. Engaging in the moral practices of other religions will lead to rebirth within samsara. Practicing the morality of the Hinayana may lead to nirvana, but this is only the nirvana of personal liberation. Since it is not the perfect and complete enlightenment, this nirvana has grave disadvantages.
Okay, so here there's made reference to the 10 non-virtuous deeds. So those would be killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, abusive language, slander, idle talk, covetousness, maliciousness, or holding perverse view, for example, not believing in karma or rebirth or the three jewels. So those are the 10 non-virtuous acts. And then he says, even if we commit only some of the minor non-virtues, this may also lead to rebirth in the lower realms. This refers to the idea that we should not discount any action, whether it's good or bad, because it's small, because they're like seeds, which then grow into large results, just like a small acorn might produce a big tree. And so we shouldn't just say, oh, well, it doesn't matter if I do this or I do that. It's only a small little thing. That's really not the way that we should be thinking, because it shows we don't understand how karma works. So it's important to not commit even minor non-virtues. As far as the morality of the Hinayana, which leads to nirvana, Apa Rinpoche says that this nirvana has grave disadvantages. Now, we made reference to this in a previous class. The word nirvana has sort of entered into the English language, and in a very inexact way, and it has sort of taken on the meaning of something really nice or really blissful or really happy. But actually, for a Mahayana practitioner, Sakya Pandita calls it poison. He says nirvana is poisonous, like poisoned food. And the reason he says that is, if you practice only for your own happiness and your own well-being and you attain nirvana, you then enter into a kind of very deep meditative state. You're happy, but you're in this meditative state for a long, long, long time, like eons and eons, which is like billions of years. And during all that time, other sentient beings are suffering, and you're not really doing anything to help them. So for a Mahayana practitioner, that's considered to be an extreme, and we want to avoid the extremes. And so instead, the goal is what they call the Great Enlightenment, which is between all extremes. And a Buddha who attains the Great Enlightenment remains engaged in helping other sentient beings who are suffering. And so that's why nirvana here is referred to as a grave disadvantage.
There are four causes of impaired morality. Number one, being ignorant of the precepts of morality. Number two, not having proper devotion and respect for the rules of morality. Number three, heedlessness in maintaining morality. And number four, being in the grip of manifold defilements. Of these four, being in the grip of manifold defilements is the strongest impairment to our morality. We should be aware that there are two methods to overcome defilements. Number one, subduing the defilements individually as they arise. And number two, discarding their seeds.
Okay, so the four causes of impaired morality. The first one is being ignorant of the precepts. So it's sort of like ignorance is no excuse for breaking the law. I'm sorry, officer, I didn't know the speed limit was 50. That's why I was going 100. That doesn't get you off. You still get a ticket. And it's the same thing here. Just because we don't know what the precepts of morality are doesn't mean we get a pass. It's our responsibility to learn them and to practice them. Not having proper devotion and respect for the rules of morality, number two, is kind of what I said before. It's like, oh, well, this doesn't really matter. It's not that important, or I'm not sure I believe that. And if we sort of don't have respect for the rules of morality, that also does not give us a pass. Heedlessness in maintaining morality, you just are sloppy and you don't act in a moral way. And then the fourth one, being in the grip of manifold defilements. Manifold defilements, what a funny term. Does anybody have an idea what manifold defilements might mean?
Many.
Sorry?
Many.
Many? Yep. Yeah. Many. What are they?
The 10 negative.
Yeah, usually there's lots of different ways of listing the defilements, but basically they're talking about the emotional defilements. Okay, our anger, our attachment, our ignorance, and also the defilements of our ignorance around the nature of reality, which is the reference that we made before to understanding emptiness. So if we're talking about the two methods for overcoming the defilements, the first one is subduing them individually and then discarding their seeds. So we're going to go into this in a minute, but basically, if we have a defilement, if we have a negative emotion, we want to do something right away to suppress it. Sort of like if you have a fire in your kitchen, you're going to take the fire extinguisher and put it out right away. But that doesn't actually remove the defilement. It doesn't remove the root of it. And we need to have a second step, and we need to go in and do that. So now we're going to find out next how to subdue the defilements individually.
Number one, subduing the defilements individually as they arise. By this method, at the very instant we find ourselves in the grip of a certain manifested defilement, such as anger, we should counteract it by reflecting on its opposite, loving kindness and compassion. Similarly, if desire arises, we should counter it on the spot by reflecting on the ugliness or impure nature of the body. In such ways, we can counteract defilements as they arise.
Okay, so this is just a very brief discussion about it. So obviously what we need to do is we need to learn what the defilements are, and then we need to learn what the antidotes are, and then we need to learn to be aware or mindful when they arise, and as soon as they arise, we need to immediately apply the antidote. And so that's the first step in subduing them, so that we can then go on further and just, as they say, discard the seeds or root out the root cause of it.
So number two, discarding their seeds. This can be achieved only by habituation in realizing selflessness. Bodhisattvas should engage in three kinds of morality. Number one, morality of discarding all non-virtuous deeds. Number two, morality of accumulating virtuous deeds. And number three, morality of performing deeds for the benefit of sentient beings.
Okay, so as far as discarding the seed by achieving the habituation and realizing selflessness, what does that mean? It means practicing the realization of emptiness of self and emptiness of phenomena. Again, that's a big topic that we won't be going into tonight. But the next sentence is, it's important to understand that bodhisattvas have three types of morality that they need to practice. So the first one is to discard all non-virtuous deeds. The non-virtuous deeds are the 10 that we listed before. But it's not enough to just stop there. It's not enough to just not do bad actions. But the second one is the morality of accumulating virtuous deeds. So we need to discard the non-virtuous deeds and then start practicing the virtuous deeds. And then the third kind of morality for a bodhisattva is performing deeds for the benefit of sentient beings, because that's what bodhisattvas do. That's what the bodhisattva path is. So now we'll go to the first one, which is morality of discarding the non-virtuous deeds.
There are two levels of morality which discard all non-virtuous deeds. One level pertains to lay practitioners and the other to celibates. With regard to lay practitioners, there are five categories. The first is the layperson who takes the refuge vows. This person is known as an upasaka who maintains refuge in the triple gem.
Upasaka.
A person who takes one of the four root precepts in addition to that, for example, not committing murder, is known as an upasaka holding one precept. One who maintains two of the five precepts is known as an upasaka observing some precepts. One who maintains three of the five precepts is known as an upasaka observing most of the precepts. One who maintains all four root vows and does not indulge in intoxicants is known as the complete upasaka. Taking the five vows also includes upholding the 10 virtuous deeds. In other words, this precept holder must promise to discard the 10 non-virtuous deeds in addition to observing the five precepts. According to certain Mahayana traditions, there is another level of lay practitioner who, in addition to taking the five basic vows, takes a vow of celibacy. This person is known as a brahmacharya, or celibate upasaka, because he observes the pure morality of a celibate in addition to the other vows. There are also lay practitioners who take the eight precepts of upavasa, not just for one day, but for their entire lives. These practitioners are known as gomi upasakas. These two types of lay precept holders, the brahmacharya upasaka and the eight precept holders, differ from other lay practitioners in that they observe the vow of celibacy. Of course, since they do not take all the vows of monks and nuns, they also differ from them. Whether we are lay practitioners or monks and nuns, provided we conjoin our vows with the Mahayana enlightenment thought, wishing to liberate all sentient beings, we will become holders of the pratimoksha, or moral vow of the Mahayana. If, on the other hand, we take and maintain our vows with only our own personal liberation in mind, our vows become Hinayana Pratimoksha vows.
Okay, so this is a long discussion about all the different kinds of vows that a person can take on the path. And in a minute, Api Rinpoche is going to explain why this is so important. To become a Buddhist, you take refuge. You take the refuge vow. So all Buddhists have at least that vow as their basis. In addition, there are all these other kinds of vows and different types, different levels, different rules to follow, and so on. But the taking of the vow is important for the practice of the bodhisattva to go along the spiritual path. And now we're going to find out why.
It is important to begin our practices with a vow, because otherwise they will not become the causes for any of the three liberations or enlightenments. As just described with regard to the pratimoksha vows, those on the Mahayana path may take the vows of a lay person, a monk or a nun, through the rituals prescribed in the Hinayana teachings, as followed by the Hinayanists, and they may also take the bodhisattva vows through the ritual systems of either the middle way or the mind-only schools. With regard to people who perform virtuous deeds without holding a vow of morality, their practice of virtue is weak and will become a cause neither for liberation nor for Buddhahood. This means that, for example, if a person who has taken the vow of not killing produces the thought in his mind, "I will not kill any other person," He produces the virtue of discarding killing every moment he is not engaged in the act of killing, because he's motivated by a mind seeking to abandon non-virtue. However, one who simply lives his life without killing does not perform the virtue of discarding killing, because he does not possess a mind seeking to abandon killing. In brief, the mere failure to commit non-virtuous acts does not produce virtue. We must therefore hold a vow of morality, which is the intention to discard non-virtuous deeds. In this way, as long as we continue not to commit non-virtuous deeds, we are actively engaging in virtue.
So, let's talk about that for a minute. So this is perhaps a little bit subtle to understand, but basically what Ape Rinpoche is saying is that there's a difference between ordinary morality and the perfection of morality, what we said at the beginning. So if I am not a bodhisattva and I have not taken the vow to not kill, but I'm just a regular person, and I see a bug, and I decide not to squish the bug and not to kill it, that's a moral act, but it's not the perfection of morality. And there's no sort of continuous accumulation of positive energy or positive merit on the path towards enlightenment. On the other hand, if I'm a bodhisattva and I've taken the vow not to kill, every moment that I'm not killing, I'm creating virtue. I'm accumulating merit. I'm accumulating virtue, even when I'm asleep. And that creates a lot more momentum, a lot more energy, if you like, towards the final goal that we're heading towards, which is perfect enlightenment or complete enlightenment. It's a subtle distinction, but it's important for us to understand this if we're going to be spiritual practitioners. And it's important for us to understand the value of vows and what we are doing when we take a vow or we don't take a vow. And also the benefit of taking them. It's a complete other situation. And that's true for any kind of virtuous or non-virtuous action.
There are two ways of training in morality, the brief and the extensive. With regard to the brief, there are three divisions: object, time, and nature. Of these three, the first is the practice of discarding non-virtue in terms of object. In order to train in morality, it is necessary to begin in a small way, with simple practices, and then gradually expand our scope. We can do this from the viewpoint of the object. For example, we should begin our practice of discarding the 10 non-virtuous deeds with close family and friends. After becoming accustomed to this, we can expand our practice of discarding killing, for example, to other human beings and animals. Likewise, with regard to discarding stealing, we should first practice with close relatives and neighbors and then extend this to include other people and finally to all sentient beings. This same method should be applied to discarding the remaining 8 non-virtuous deeds, such as telling lies and so forth.
So this might sound kind of strange at first, to practice not killing first with your family, but there are people who do kill their families. And if a person has a lot of negativity and they have a lot of propensity in that direction, the Mahayana path, the Sutrayana path, is a gradual path. And we need to start slowly and small and develop the habit of the morality that we're practicing. The same thing is true with stealing. You might say, well, that's funny. You practice not stealing from your family first. But there are people who steal from their families. It does happen. And so for some people, we need to start at the very beginning. When we were on the chapter of generosity, we talked about very, very, very small acts of generosity for very stingy people, like giving a glass of water, a small glass of water, or giving a small cup of cooked vegetables. And some people need to start at that level and then slowly and gradually build it and build the habit of it and create a propensity towards generosity or morality or whatever it is. And through that gradual, slow process, we can build up the spiritual energy that we need to take our morality forward and perfect the perfections and do them gradually.
From the perspective of time, one should first try to practice not committing any of these non-virtuous deeds for half a day, and gradually extend it to a full day, a week, a fortnight, then a full month, and so on, up to an entire year or more. We can also train from the viewpoint of nature of the deed, observing one vow in the beginning, and then gradually increasing the number of vows we keep.
So sometimes the question is asked, well, where should I start? Which one should I start with? And the answer that is usually given is you should examine yourself and decide what is your worst trait. What is the biggest obscuration or the biggest problem that you have, the biggest non-virtue that you have, and start with that one. Start with the worst one and get that under control, and then go on to the next one.
If for some reason we impair our morality, we must restore it immediately by confessing our misdeeds. If we commit an immoral deed in the morning, we must make sure we confess it before going to sleep that night. If we commit a non-virtuous deed at night, we must confess it the next morning when we wake up, before taking any food. If we are always conscientious about confessing, we will become genuine Dharma practitioners. Buddha taught that there are two kinds of noble persons: those who never impair their morality, and those who confess their infractions immediately.
Okay, some teachers say that immediately means within 4 hours. So in other words, as soon as you recognize that you've done something, you should confess it. The Buddha taught there are two kinds of noble persons: those who never impair their morality, good luck, or the rest of us, those who do and need to confess immediately. And also, we've talked about confession before, that it's really important to practice confession and the ritual of confession, because you don't know what your previous karma is. You don't know what you did in previous lifetimes. Those deeds that are not confessed and removed karmically, we have to experience.
Number two, the morality of accumulating virtuous deeds. The second practice of morality, which must be undertaken by bodhisattvas, is the accumulation of merit. The accumulation of merit means to practice morality and also to abandon unfavorable conditions which obstruct the accomplishment of virtuous deeds. For example, if we listen to Buddha's teachings or study them, this itself is a virtuous deed. If we find ourselves being obstructed by negative forces such as laziness, we must identify them and overcome them so we can continue our study vigorously. Abandoning negativities such as laziness is itself a virtuous deed and will improve our capacity for undertaking practices to accumulate merit, such as listening to the teachings and so forth. To give a further example, when we take refuge in the Triple Gem, it is possible that we may be obstructed by lack of faith. In order to overcome this, we must generate appropriate respect and devotion towards the Triple Gem by reflecting on their qualities. This becomes a virtuous deed in itself. It will strengthen our affirmation of the Triple Gem and add to our accumulation of merit. In brief, to collect or accumulate merit means not only performing virtuous deeds, but also overcoming the negative forces which obstruct our performance of virtuous deeds.
So this is kind of interesting, because usually when we speak about morality, we think about not doing something bad or not doing something wrong, which is the first kind of morality. But the Bodhisattva also practices the second kind of morality, which is accumulating merit. Merit is just another word for positive spiritual energy. And we need to accumulate that in order to realize emptiness or the nature of reality. Without a lot of spiritual energy, we will never attain that, because that's very difficult attainment, and it is really the crown jewel of the Buddha's teaching and one of the things that separates Buddhism from other paths. But it's not an easy thing to achieve. And so in order to realize that, we need to have lots and lots of merit. So Apa Rinpoche explains that this accumulation of merit means to not only abandon non-virtuous actions, but also to abandon the unfavorable conditions which obstruct the accomplishment of virtuous deeds. So he gives the example of laziness. Laziness is usually thought of as, oh, well, I don't feel like doing it. That's kind of what we think of when we think about laziness. I don't know. I don't feel like it, which is one kind of laziness. Another kind of laziness is to be overly busy and not do your practice. So that's the thing that Westerners, a lot of us, have to deal with. We get really busy. We have jobs, families, we have pets, we have life. We have to go do all the things that we think we have to do, and we don't practice. Oh, I'll do it tomorrow, I'll do it next week, or I really would like to, but I don't know, I'm kind of busy. And that's actually a form of laziness in this context. Another kind of laziness is a sort of spiritual low self-esteem. Oh, I'm not good enough. I can't do this. It's too hard. This path is really long. It's really a lot of work. I'm not up to it. I don't know if I'm really cut out for this path. And that kind of spiritual, I don't think I'm good enough, is actually a form of laziness. So it's important that we understand this kind of two-sided coin here that we have here, that we not only have to abandon non-virtue, but we also have to confront the obstacles that keep us from doing virtue.
Number three, the morality of performing deeds for the benefit of sentient beings. In order to work for the benefit of sentient beings, we must first overcome any unfavorable conditions which may impede us. For example, if an ordained Mahayana practitioner needs to transgress any of the four major vows in order to accomplish the greater benefit of sentient beings, he should do so, even if it means breaking his ordination vows.
Okay, this requires a little bit of explanation. We've talked about this before, but I think it bears repeating. This is one of the distinctions between a Mahayana path and a Hinayana path, so a greater vehicle or a lesser vehicle path. So if a person is a Hinayana practitioner, they will never break their moral vows for any reason, because it's primary for them. Whereas a Mahayana practitioner evaluates the situation and decides what's best for the benefit of sentient beings, even if it means breaking their vows, like it says here. The classic example that's given is the Hinayana practitioner or the Mahayana practitioner walking in the woods. They see a deer go running by, and it goes off down a trail. Shortly thereafter, the hunter follows and says, "Hey, did you guys see a deer?" And because the Hinayana practitioner never breaks the moral vow, one of which is to not lie, he tells the truth and he tells the hunter, yeah, the deer went that way. If the hunter asks the Mahayana practitioner, because he judges the situation according to what's the best benefit for the sentient being involved in the situation, he will actually lie to the hunter and say, oh, the deer went that away, because he can save the deer's life that way, and saving the deer's life has a higher value than holding the vow not to lie. And so that's one of the distinctions that's made. And there's lots of stories in the Jataka tales, which are the stories of the Buddha's previous lifetimes, where the Buddha demonstrates this principle by his actions.
With regard to unerringly undertaking the perfection of morality, there are four qualities to be adopted and seven attachments to be abandoned. These were explained previously in conjunction with the perfection of generosity. They apply to the perfection of morality and to all the other perfections. You want me to read this story?
Yeah. So let me just say something. Now we're going to get into a story here. And when Sakya Pandita wrote his text, he wrote it for beginners, but he also wrote it for teachers. And at a lot of different points in the text, he will say, oh, and at this point, the teacher should tell the story about so-and-so and so-and-so and what they did and so-and-so. But he doesn't have the story in this book, because if you're a teacher, you should know the story. So what Ape Rinpoche's book has is not all of the stories, but a lot of the stories that we need to know that are not in this book. So now we're going to hear one of these stories.
There are many stories in the scriptures to illustrate how a bodhisattva must transgress the morality of discarding non-virtuous deeds when it's necessary to do so for the benefit of sentient beings. Two of these stories will be mentioned here. The first is about a Brahmin named Karma. He lived a very long time ago, in the days when people were able to live for thousands of years. This Brahmin renounced the world and became a monk. He went to live in a forest to meditate, where he remained meditating very diligently and well for 4,200 years. After that time, he went to a nearby town and stayed in a king's palace. One day, a trader's daughter came to the palace and saw him. She was very attracted to him and went to his room to ask him to marry her. The monk Karma told her that she should not speak of such a thing to him, as he had renounced the world. Then the girl replied that if he got up and walked away from her, she would kill herself the moment he took the seventh step. The monk thought to himself that he had renounced the world and taken vows, so he could not marry this girl. Thereupon he stood up and began to walk away. Then, just as he was about to take the seventh step, he realized that if the girl were to kill herself in his room, it would be terrible for her and cause a great scandal. He then resolved that she should be an object of his great compassion, and that he should break his vows to save her, even if it meant going to hell as a result. In other words, it was more important to save the girl than to save himself. Thus, he turned back from taking the seventh step and accepted the girl as his wife. After they had lived together for 12 years, he renounced the world again and went away to practice for a long time. It is said that he was reborn in a heavenly realm. This shows that instead of attaining a negative result through that deed, he accumulated a vast amount of merit by resolving to put someone else's benefit before his own. That Brahmin Karma was the Buddha Shakyamuni in one of his previous lives.
So this was a Jataka tale.
Second story?
Mm-hmm. Here's another story.
Another story about a ship's captain. At one time, there were 500 traders who had been sailing around the ocean and visiting many islands in search of jewels. Having had a highly successful trip, they embarked on the return journey. One of the ship's crew members, who had seen the traders' collection of riches, conceived a plan to kill them all and steal their jewels. The ship's captain became aware of this crew member's intention. As this captain was a man of great compassion, he tried to think of ways to prevent this deed. However, he could not think of a viable plan. He knew that if this evil man were to kill all the traitors, he would be reborn in the hell realms for a very long time indeed. He felt compassion and thought to himself that if he were to kill the man before he could carry out his nefarious plan, he'd save him from having to face such sufferings in the future. Therefore, with the intention of exchanging his own benefit and happiness for the suffering of others, the ship's captain killed the man. It is said that instead of being born in the hell realms, the captain accumulated a lot of merit, equivalent to what he would have accumulated through practicing virtue for 9 eons. Therefore, instead of being a negative deed, this act of killing became a positive one. Again, this captain was Buddha Shakyamuni in one of his previous lives. According to the Hinayana tradition, one must never at any time break the four principal vows of an ordained person: killing, stealing, sexual conduct, and lying. It is said that one's spiritual life would be ruined by breaking any of these. However, according to the Mahayana tradition, provided that we are motivated by compassion and the enlightenment thought, we must break the four vows if it is necessary to do so to benefit others. There is no fault.
But you better be sure your motivation is pure. Otherwise, you have the karmic result of your action.
The benefits of maintaining morality. Maintaining morality conveys great benefits. First, with regard to the temporary benefits, we will never regret our actions in this life. Our mind will remain contented, and we will attain various states of meditative absorption in addition to various realizations. Our conduct will bring joy to others, and they will revere us. We will even become fields of offering. In brief, many great benefits accrue from maintaining morality. Through maintaining our morality in this lifetime, we will be reborn in the higher realms of humans and gods and possess special qualities such as higher status, prosperity, wisdom, power, long life, beauty, and freedom from diseases. Second, the ultimate result of maintaining morality is the attainment of perfect Buddhahood. When we become Buddhas, our fame will spread widely. Everybody will call us teacher, not only in the world of human beings, but also in the world of the devas. In addition, by becoming a Buddha, we will also attain the quality of being free from the three concealments, as extolled by Arya Maitreya in Mahayana Sutra Lamkara. Unlike worldly people, Buddha need not hide any of his behavior of body, voice, or mind to demonstrate that he's holy.
So these benefits that Apa Rinpoche lists, this is kind of the condensed version of the benefits, especially when he lists the benefits as the ultimate benefits. The ultimate benefit means when you become fully enlightened, you become a fully enlightened Buddha. What's the fruit of all of your actions here, of all your path? The qualities of the Buddha are many and extensive, and later on in this text, there is a whole chapter devoted to the qualities and various states of a Buddha, a completely enlightened being. And they are really, really amazing. And I can't wait to get to that chapter because it's really an eye-opener to see what that is like. So what we have here is just, Apa Rinpoche is just briefly touching on the benefits. But stay tuned, there's more to come. So that concludes the fifth chapter, the chapter of the perfection of morality. And I'm just wondering, we have a group of people here that you can't see online, but I'm just wondering if there's any discussion or questions. And I would just ask that people kind of keep their comments brief because I have to repeat them into the microphone here so that the online people can hear what you have to say. So if you could sort of be pithy in what you are going to say, I'd like to just open it up to discussion and questions.
Well, I've got a question regarding the Hinayana Nibbana. Eons and eons of residing in that state. Would you say that one of the dangers could be an ultimate form of boredom?
So the question is the Hinayana Nirvana, could it be considered an ultimate form of boredom? Well, not having ever been there, I'm not sure I can say firsthandedly, but I've never heard it described that way. It's total bliss, complete happiness, the absence of suffering, it's liberation from samsara. You're completely out of the cycle of birth and death and rebirth and death and suffering.
So what's wrong with all of that?
There's nothing wrong with it. It's wonderful.
But it goes on and on.
But it goes on indefinitely, and in the meantime, you're not helping any other sentient being who's suffering. And a Mahayana practitioner does a lot of practice to develop compassion for other sentient beings who have been their mother or father in previous lifetimes, not only once, but many times, and shown complete and great compassion and love and kindness and sacrifice and all kinds of things. All you have to do is just think about the people who have sacrificed for you to get you where you are, whether it be to give you life or clothes or an education or whatever. And to, from a Mahayana point of view, to just go off into bliss and leave those people behind suffering. And remember, some of them are suffering in very terrible, terrible situations, in hell realms, in hungry ghost realms, in suffering animal realms. Actually, all the realms are of samsara are suffering. So from a Mahayana point of view, that's not really the highest path. That doesn't mean that the Hinayana path is criticized. The Hinayana path is a path that was taught by the Buddha. He taught three paths, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. And they're all valid paths because there's different kinds of people with different propensities. And some people need one kind of path and some people like another kind of path. You know, some people like chocolate, some people like vanilla. It doesn't mean that vanilla, that's not saying there's anything wrong with the other flavor. But the Buddha, in his wisdom, he was also clairvoyant and he could see what people needed. And so he taught these paths for different types of people. But again, this text is a Mahayana text, and it's from that point of view that the teachings are given. And so that's why nirvana is not considered a good goal for a Mahayana practitioner. In fact, it's considered an extreme, as we said before. I seriously doubt, though, that arhats are bored. I just don't think they are. I think they're in bliss. But they're not really actively helping other beings, and that's the difference between nirvana and complete perfect enlightenment.
I actually think that unending bliss could get very boring. I just suspect that.
Can you say that louder again?
I suspect that unending bliss could get boring. We're talking eons.
Well, hopefully we'll never know because we won't take that path.
Learning it's for others, you know, for the suffering, to help alleviate the sufferings of others. Because again, as you're saying, that, you know, Michael, that so many people are suffering in so many horrific ways around the planet and the world. How do we help them? And then learning that with the wisdom, it's the balance of both. If you want to put it this way, nirvana and the hell realm. So it's a balance of both. It's not one or the other, or it's not too much of one or the other. It's the balance. Is that making sense? I'm not making sense.
The balance of both of what? Sorry, I'm trying to get the question clear here.
Sorry. Not getting too much into one way or the other, but being in a balance.
The middle path.
Yeah, in a sense. Like I'm not saying this very well, sorry. I'll ponder that a bit more, sorry.
Okay, so what Jenny is saying, I think,
yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Jenny, that there's so many beings that are suffering. And if we really want to help them, if we are really bodhisattvas with the idea, the motivation to help, we need to have balance in our life. We need to have the middle path. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what Jenny's saying the balance is. The balance is between...
not between bliss or happiness. And not too much suffering. It's, again, the balance of both. I'm sorry, I'm not saying this very well.
Okay. So Jenny's saying it's not too much bliss and not too much suffering, but a middle path.
Yeah.
And that, I'm going to put words in your mouth, so correct me if I'm doing this not to your liking. Mm-hmm. That then motivates us on the path.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's the Mahayana, path, the Bodhisattva's path.
The wisdom of balance, or the balance of wisdom, rather, you know, it's that, because it's just starting, I hadn't quite realized, again, the balance, that it's, it's just at a level that's not too much of the other or too much of the other, you know, the two extremes, again, it's some balance.
Yeah.
How to get that balance.
So Jenny's saying the word balance. She's saying we need the balance of wisdom and method, and we need to to have not extremes. We need to have the middle path. Yeah, that's what the Buddha said too. Coincidentally, Jenny.
Learning that slowly but surely. You know?
Yeah. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Maybe someday we'll be able to take questions online here. We haven't quite got the technology down pat yet, but at some point we might.
Right.
By the way, this talk should be online for a while. If you know somebody that missed the Facebook Live telecast of it, it should be online on the Victoria Buddhist Dharma Society Facebook page, and they can go and click on the video and watch it again.
Uh-huh. Well, I got something did occur to me when about the story of the hunter chasing the deer. And I have compassion for the deer, but what about the hunter's family who might be awfully hungry and he doesn't bring...
They should be vegetarian.
And many cultures have no vegetables. Particularly, is this really a call to vegetarianism?
So Sybil's saying it's fine to be compassionate for the deer. What about the poor hunter and his family that he has to feed? And some cultures don't have a lot of vegetables, and does this mean everybody has to be vegetarian? This is one of those topics that is hotly debated among Buddhists, and it kind of depends on who you talk to, what kind of answer you get. I'm a vegetarian, but my first teacher, Geshe Tashi Namgo, was not. He was from Tibet, and he ate meat, and he liked it. And this topic was hotly debated numerous evenings among students and teacher. Certainly we want to have compassion for the hunter because we have compassion for all beings. And according to some teachers, if that hunter were to kill the deer, there would be some negative karma accrued. So that's part of the motivation of the Mahayana person who says the deer went a that away and not a that away. My personal opinion is that everybody has to think about this for themselves and decide for themselves that it's not good enough to just ignore it. It's like one of the guidelines in the book said, you have to know what the rules are around morality because the law of karma applies to everybody. So I don't think it's good enough to just close your eyes to the issue. But on the other hand, we're all responsible for our own karma. And the Buddha himself said that. He said, I can't do it for you. I can show you the way, but you got to do it yourself. So my answer is think about it, meditate on it, maybe talk to some other people, especially teachers, see what they think, and do what's right for you. And I'm sure that a lot of people will disagree with my opinion, but it's one of those topics.
Yeah, it's a good topic.
Mm-hmm. Save the deer and confess your lies that night.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is we do create non-virtue on a continuous basis, even when we don't realize it. That's why the confession practice is so important. Mm-hmm. It's important to do, as we said, right away. Don't even wait half a day. As soon as you realize you've done it, confess it. It's important to learn the confession ritual so that you do it correctly. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, then your karma is removed. But you've got to do the ritual, you've got to do the practice. It doesn't just go away because you wish it away.
It doesn't just go away because you acknowledged it. You have to acknowledge it and do something else.
That's part of it, but that's not the whole practice. And so what you should do is you should find a teacher that you can learn the practice from correctly and then do the practice completely. Because there are a number of steps that have to be fulfilled before the karma is actually removed.
Right.
That would be an interesting teaching to have sometime.
That would be very important.
Just thinking that.
Yeah. We would. I would ask for that teaching.
Well, we'll ask Lama and see if he'll do it.
Yeah.
And if he assigns it to somebody else, then we'll see. But it's really important. And I know in the beginning I didn't realize it, and I think a lot of people don't realize it. Confession is really important. And in fact, when we do our prayers, and we're going to do the concluding prayers here shortly, mm-hmm. at the very end of the prayers that we say, one of the things that we say is, I confess. It's a very brief version, but it's just to remind us that this is part of our practice. There's seven things that we do in our practice, and that's one of the seven. So this is why we have classes. This is why we study. This is why we contemplate. This is why we meditate. So that we can learn what the practices are and go forward on the path, create the merit, get the spiritual energy, the momentum going towards final fruit of enlightenment. But certainly confessing is one of them, and it's something, and so are the other six. So it's really important to learn what they are if you're going to do the path, and then no problem. Life becomes worthwhile. Mm-hmm.
And I know being really grateful for a certain practice, like the confession and the practices you can do that help cleanse your merit. But I hear what you're saying too. You need to do the whole full practice of doing that, confessing, and then the different elements with that. But yeah, and then the different practices you can do that help cleanse and purify that merit and negative karma.
Yeah. So Jenny's reiterating what I just said, that the practice is important, and there are other practices that are important too. Mm-hmm. By the way, there are different kinds of confession practices. There's not just one, there's different ones. Some of them are briefer and some of them are more extensive and so on. But yeah, it's important to do.
Thank you, Michael.
Any other comments, questions, or complaints? Okay.
Just many thanks.
Yeah, so that's the end of the fifth chapter. We will be doing this again next week if people want to come or tune in. And one of the seven practices that we do is dedication. And so we will now do the dedication prayers, which are the dedication practice. And what dedication does is it sort of seals your merit, the merit that we've generated by doing the practice. In this case, we're studying a text, so that creates positive merit, right? And the dedication then shares it. It's because we are Mahayana practitioners, we're doing our practice, including this evening, for the benefit of all beings. So the dedication spreads the wealth, so to speak, and it also seals it, so to speak, so that it won't be destroyed by a negative action, for example, anger. So the dedication is always the final concluding step in any practice that we want to do. The first step is going for refuge. The middle step is the practice itself. And the final step, or the third step, is the dedication. So now we'll read the dedication prayer in English. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I may train to be like them. Through this dedication, praised as supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for listening.